Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. We just wrapped up the Northwest Arkansas Regional Conference. It's a great time. Packed out. People were happy to be out at an event again. When I say packed out, I mean it could fit no more people at that venue. But it was a great time. And it turns out that even though that event is over, registration is open for the national event in San Diego. So you can jump over to 1517.org, find that event, and you can register to hang out with us for 3 days over in San Diego in October. It's going to be a blast. If you've never gone, then you need to go. If you have gone, it's back. I mean, we haven't done this in 3 years now because of COVID, but we are doing it this year. Chad and I will both be there. We'll be happy to be back at our home away from home over there at Mission Bay in San Diego. And so hopefully you will come and join us. Chad, after hanging out in person, we didn't get an opportunity to record live, so we're just back on the computer, but we are in 1 Kings chapter 18.
Yeah, we're going to pick up the story of what's going to go on with Elijah. In the last chapter, we talked about how he was taken care of by the ravens. The ravens were bringing him his breakfast and his supper every day. And then he had to move away from there to the area around the Phoenicians, to the region of Tyre and Sidon. God took care of him there too with a widow who provided him with a place to stay and three meals a day. And then he provided her with, the ongoing provisions of the oil that didn't run out, and the flour that didn't run out. But then he also, when her son got sick and died, he provided him with life again. So that was chapter 17. And we're introduced to Elijah. We find out a little bit about him, where he's been, what he's been up to. And we're also told that when all this was going on, there was a severe drought and thus a severe famine that was taking place in the land of Israel. And this doesn't go on for just, you know, a few months or just even a year, but for 3 years. So this is God's way of very vividly reminding the Israelites that though they are worshiping the god Baal, who's the god of fertility and weather and storms and whatnot, that god is impotent, of course, because he's not a non-entity. He's not able to provide the land with the rain. So all that is kind of the setup for what's going to happen here in chapter 18. Because Ahab is going to confront Elijah is going to confront Ahab, and then he's going to call all Israel to this duel, this prophetic showdown that's going to take place on Mount Carmel. So the first part of the chapter, though, is kind of an extensive dialogue between a guy named Obadiah, not to be confused with the prophet by that name, with a guy named Obadiah and Elijah himself. So here's how it sets it up. Chapter 18 begins, "After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year." This, by the way, this theme of thirds is going to come up. It's already come up once, because when the son of the widow became sick and died, Elijah stretched himself out on the child three times and cried to the Lord to let the child's life return. So there we have the theme of life coming on the third day. Course, a very clear resurrection theme. But here, it's going to be kind of the same thing. So it's going to be the third year. So after this time of death, we might say, famine, drought, deprivation, hunger, after that time in the grave, as it were, for the nation, now in the third year, there's going to come restoration. There's going to come resuscitation, and it's going to come in the form of rain, which we'll get to at the end of the chapter. So third year, word of the Lord comes to Elijah and says, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." So Ahab, of course, being the king of the northern kingdom, the one who has married Jezebel, the Phoenician princess, who has brought this this theological cancer of the worship of Baal and the worship of Asherah into the heart of Israel. So verse 2 says, Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab, we're told, called Obadiah, who was over his household. Now, Obadiah has an interesting name. His name actually means servant of Yahweh. So the name itself is indicative of the fact that this is a guy who has not abandoned, at least if he's living up to his name, has not abandoned worship of the true God. So Ahab, he's working for Ahab. So as we'll see, he's kind of in a tense position. So he's a believer and a worshiper and a fearer of Yahweh, but he's employed by, not just employed by, but he's like the main guy to this Israelite king who's gone off the rails into Baal worship and Asherah worship. So Ahab calls Obadiah over his household, and we're told, it kind of in your English translations, we'll have this in parentheses, this kind of a footnote, if you will, about Obadiah. Here's how he's described. Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, and when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water. End parentheses here. That's, you know, you got to give it to Obadiah. That's, first of all, that is quite a logistical feat.
Right, yeah.
You got to find two big caves. You got to put 50 prophets in one, 50 prophets in another. And even if they're on, you know, rations, that's a lot of food and a lot of water to feed these guys for presumably an extended amount of time. That's what Obadiah is doing. And by the way, just a reminder here, I know we've talked about this before, but it doesn't hurt to repeat it. When it says that Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, that doesn't mean that he was simply afraid of God. The verb yara, this is an adjective that's used here in the Hebrew, but the verb yara, to which is usually translated to fear, is kind of it's an all-encompassing verb in the Old Testament. It can certainly mean to be afraid of, but it also is used synonymously with trust, with serve, with worship, so that it's kind of it's like the container that holds a lot of different verbs. So when you say you fear God in the Old Testament, that means you believe in him, that means you serve him, that means you worship him, that you have a healthy fear, respect for him because he is God and you are not. So all of those are compressed into Obadiah, fearing the Lord greatly. We, you know, in Christian parlance, we might say that he was a strong believer, or he was a faithful worshiper of God, something like that.
Whenever I see in the scripture where it says that somebody feared God, I always just read that as, this is a man who understands the power hierarchy of the universe.
That's a good way to put it.
Right. So yeah. He understands God's place and he understands his place. So he's that kind of guy. Which, yeah. The Bible is full of people who don't understand that. They don't understand that God is God and you are creature. They don't understand that order.
They reverse it.
Yeah. But he understands that. And so he fears God. It's just that he knows that God is God and he is not.
Yeah, yeah. And it's kind of an irony here. We'll see as the narrative unfolds here that he does. I mean, he does fear the Lord greatly. But we're also reminded that that doesn't mean that you don't also struggle with other fears, because he fears the Lord greatly, but as we'll find out in just a minute, he's also afraid that the king is going to take his life. So that we'll get to that in just a second. So verse 5, Ahab said to Obadiah, go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals. So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. So, of course, you know, things are, they're in dire straits. No rain, of course, obviously means that you have sparse vegetation. You got these hungry animals, and they're going to just try and at least find some spots here in the low places where water runs down or by the springs of water where they can give them at least some grazing so that they will be able to survive through this famine. I can't imagine. I mean, one year, I mean, I grew up in a farm community. I know that if you have a bad year, it's bad. It's bad for the animals. It's bad for the farmers. It's bad for their families. It's bad for the community. But I can't imagine going through not one, but two, but 3 years of this. I mean, I guess if you look back in you know, somewhat recent past, to the Dust Bowl days of America, you kind of get a feel for what this would have done, what this would have been like for not just those involved in agriculture, but the entire area that was affected by this.
I remember growing up, I grew up sort of on a farm for part of my life. It wasn't like a farm, like a farm that produced things for other people. We lived off the land kind of deal. Like, we lived out in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, we had our own cows, and we had our own chickens, our own pigs, and our own garden, and all that kind of stuff. We weren't making a living manufacturing, growing food for the rest of the community or anything, but the food that we had, for the most part, was the food that we grew, whether it was from the ground or the animals that we raised. And we also didn't live in a place that had, you know, city water or anything like that. It'd be pretty far out. So we had a well. And I remember one summer was particularly hot and went a long, long period with no rain. And the well ran dry. It was dry, and we had no water in the well for quite a while, at least a month. And just that, 1 month of no water in the well, and the creek was, we had a creek near the house, and that was dry, running, that was dry. And things got real tense.
Yes, I bet they did.
Can't get water to the animals, can't water the you know, the garden, don't have water, you're pulling the little water you can out of the creek, boiling it, all this kind of stuff. That's a month. Mm. And you started to get kind of worried that, I don't know, what are we going to do? Whenever I hear about droughts in the Bible, I always think back to that, because I'm like, 3 years?
Yeah.
No water for 3 years? It's a miracle everyone's not dead.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's something you can identify with. And, you know, for I think most people today have never experienced anything close to that. I mean, at the most, maybe, you know, there's been, like, we had a horrible freeze here in Texas last year, and we didn't have water, and the water that did eventually came out was not safe to drink, so you're boiling your water. I mean, so compared to a drought, that's nothing. But, you know, it's a little taste for just how, it's a reminder to us, I suppose, of how much we take for granted. I mean, yeah. I can walk in my kitchen, walk in my bathroom, turn to the water, assume not only that water's going to come out, but that it's safe to drink. I give no thought most days to the fact that there's water, clean water available for me. But when you know, if you experience something like that, or you experience through another person what happens when you have a drought, it really brings home just how crucial rainfall is.
Yep.
So 3 years this went by.
By the way, there was no baths for like a month.
That probably made the situation tense.
Yeah. So if you're wondering, when the well runs dry, baths are the first thing to go. Like, even when the well starts getting low, baths are the first thing to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Last January, I went 3 days without a shower, and I thought that was bad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that going on much longer. So that's the situation. And verse 7 says that Obadiah, as he was taking some of the animals looking for grazing, he was on the way, and behold, Elijah meets him. So Elijah has obviously left his hideout with a widow in Zarephath, and he has gone to meet Obadiah. Obadiah knows him, recognized him, falls on his face and says, "Is it you, my Lord Elijah?" And Elijah says, "Yes, it is me." And then he's very laconic here, you know, as we'll see. Obadiah is just can't shut up. He just goes on and on. But Elijah is very brief in the speech that he delivers. He says, "Yes, it's me. Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here." Pretty short message. Behold, Elijah is here. And Obadiah, here's his first words. "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me?" So, You can tell from this then that Obadiah's reaction to just running into Elijah out here in the middle of nowhere is not necessarily positive. You know, when he says, "Is it you, my Lord Elijah?" That's not necessarily, you know, a note of excitement, like, "Wow, is it you?" Because what he hears from him is not really what he wants to hear, because he's afraid that as we'll see, he's afraid that if he delivers this message to Ahab, Ahab's basically going to cut him down. He's going to take him out. It's funny how when Elijah confronts people, all of a sudden they're thinking about their sin. Same thing happened with the widow, right?
Right.
Her son gets sick, dies. She says to Elijah, you coming to my house has brought my sin to the Lord's attention. And because of that, he's killed my child. Same thing here with Obadiah. How have I sinned? What did I do wrong? That you're basically going to send me on a suicide mission here.
I suppose maybe most people, I'm trying to imagine, Chad, if all of a sudden you were told, so, I mean, what is Elijah's the messenger from God, right? He's that word angel, but he's a messenger. Mm-hmm. I suppose if I was told the guy, like, so the messenger of the Lord is going to come to you tomorrow and tell you something, I got to admit, I don't know that I would be like, okay, this is probably going to be something great. I might be a little freaked out. I'd be like, oh, crap.
I probably wouldn't be happy about it either. I probably said this on the podcast before, but you know when Elijah has his vision in chapter 6 and God says, you know, who will go for us? Whom shall I send? And Elijah, and Isaiah's like, you know, jumping up in the back, raising his hand. Here am I. Send me. I can almost guarantee you he regretted being just so exuberant about his willingness to be a prophet, especially the very speech that God gives him after that basically says, your job is going to be terrible. Here's what you're going to do. Nobody's going to listen to you. You're going to preach and preach. Nobody's going to pay any attention to you.
Yeah, I got to be honest. If God was like, I'm looking for somebody, just one person to go do a thing, it's very important, I would be yelling. I wouldn't be yelling, here I am. I'd be yelling, not it.
I'd be like with Saul hiding behind the wagon baggage or wherever he was hiding that one time.
Nope.
Yeah. I'd be like, now that guy over there, he would be good for that job.
Yeah.
I highly suggest you send him. So he goes on, verse 10, how have I sinned, so on and so forth. And then he goes on to say, as the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord, he's talking about Ahab, where my Lord has not sent to seek you. And when they would say, he's not here, he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. So evidently, during this whole time, Ahab has been on the hunt for Elijah. He's been looking for him here. He's been looking for him there. He's been, you know, probably sent some spies down into Judah to look for him. Maybe he sent some people across the Jordan River into the Transjordan area to look for him. No doubt they checked out Phoenicia looking for him, which is, of course, where he was. He was just a stone's throw there from the heart of Phoenicia, and nobody found him. So he's been looking all over the place, and when they didn't find him, he would even make those people swear, take an oath, saying, no, we did not find him. He's not here. So all of that's gone down. And that helps to explain why Obadiah is so nervous. He goes on to verse 11. And now, so given all that background, now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. Here's what's going to happen, Obadiah says. As soon as I've gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you, I don't know where. And so when I come and tell Ahab and he can't find you, he's going to kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. He just goes on and on and on. In fact, now he's going to give his credentials. He's going to say, here's what I've done. Has it not been told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah's here, and he will kill me. This is, I was reading Robert Alter's translation/commentary this morning, and he pinpoints this whole dialogue as a good example of what he calls contrastive dialogue, where you basically have these two individuals who are in a conversation, and there's a clear difference in just in the way everything comes across in the way they're approaching this. So Elijah is like, you kind of get the impression Elijah is just standing there. He's very confident. You know, he has the Lord on his side. He's laconic in his speech. He's, you know, just states things very briefly and bluntly. Here's what's going to happen. And then Obadiah just goes on and on and on and on, repeating himself and giving a reason for his fears, and he just can't stop because he's nervous, he's afraid, so on and so forth. So good example of how the text sets that up is two different portrayals of the participants in this conversation.
Yeah, I do feel like I would just exactly how it would be. I mean, if I was hiding prophets out in a cave, feeding them, all this stuff, and I was, you know, doing some, you know, pretty dangerous stuff. I was putting myself on the side of the Lord here, and then somebody was like, "I need you to go to that king, who is a straight murderer, and tell him that you saw Elijah, but you haven't brought him." I'd be like, "Oh, come on, man, dude! I've been out here trying to do the right thing. What was the point of me trying to do all this stuff if I'm just gonna go walk right into this dude's living room and give him a message that certainly he's going to end up killing me for?"
Yeah. This story is a perfect example of one of my favorite proverbs: no good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah, man. I'm sure he's just like, "Man, look, I've been out here busting my butt, like trying to keep people alive and stuff. And now you really want me to just go commit suicide?"
Yeah. Yeah. You can completely understand Obadiah's perspective here. So, after saying all of this, Elijah, I guess he feels kind of sorry for Obadiah. So he himself swears an oath. So all these nations and kingdoms had to swear an oath. Elijah's not here. Now Elijah himself is going to give his words, going to swear an oath. He says, "As the Lord of hosts, as Yahweh of armies lives, before whom I stand," that's servant language. When you stand before someone, you serve them. "Before him I stand, I will surely show myself to him today." So once he's taken an oath, once he's said this so emphatically to Obadiah, Obadiah is basically like, "Okay, all right, now I believe you." So Obadiah goes to meet Ahab, catches up with him wherever he's at, and tells him about this whole scenario. And then Ahab goes to meet Elijah. So now we have king confronting prophet, prophet confronting king, which we will see a lot in not only Kings, but we also see this, of course, in the books of Isaiah. We see this in the book of Jeremiah as well. We've seen it already with Nathan and David, of course. So the prophet confronting a king is a very common scenario that you have in the Old Testament. So Ahab goes to meet Elijah. Verse 17 says, "When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab was the first one to speak. Now, when Obadiah met him, he says, 'Is it you, my Lord Elijah?' When Ahab meets Elijah, here's what he says: 'Is it you, you troubler of Israel?'" Which is exactly what you would expect from a guy like Ahab. So Ahab, who is the problem, keep in mind, the problem is Ahab, and Elijah will tell him this in just a minute. But of course, the problem is him, and he shifts responsibility completely now to the prophet. He's saying, "You're the guy. You're the problem. You're the one who's troubling Israel. You're the one who's caused all of these issues for the nation. So you're the issue. It's not me." And by the way, there's a rich background to this word here. So if you go back to Joshua chapter 7, that's the story of Achan and the taking of Jericho. That was when Achan went in. You know, he stole some of the loot that was supposed to be part of the harem, the stuff devoted to destruction. And then he eventually is found out because the nation of Israel is defeated after that when they try and take on the city of Ai. So back in the book of Joshua, all that stuff goes down. And when they find out who the culprit is, and Achan confesses, here's what they say. This is Joshua speaking to Achan. "Why did you bring trouble on us? The Lord brings trouble on you." So that Hebrew word is the exact word that's used here for a troubler of Israel. And then when they stone Achan, they call that place the Valley of Achor, which means the Valley of Trouble. So all that's the background here to Ahab saying basically to Elijah, "You're Achan. You're the one troubling Israel. You're the cause of this national calamity that's taken place in the form of a famine," just like Achan was the cause of the national calamity that happened back in the book of Joshua. So he has things completely backwards, but that's perspective that Ahab has when he confronts him. Now, Elijah himself, when he's accused of being the troubler, he answers, I have not troubled Israel, but you have, Ahab, you and your father's house. Why? Because you have abandoned the commandments of Yahweh and followed after the Baals. And then he ends it, verse 19, by saying, now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So he switches things around. He says, no, I'm not the problem. You're the problem. And here's why you're the problem. Because you have basically, you've broken the covenant. You've abandoned the commandments of the Lord. Of course, in abandoning the first, he's abandoned all the rest of them. And he's not only abandoned them, but he's also then gone after the Baals. And the reason that's in the plural is probably because Baal was often associated with different areas. So you'll often have Baal associated with a place name. And so that's most likely why you have the plural there. But it's not just Baal that's the issue. You also have his consort, Asherah, and you have all of their ministers, all of their prophets. So you got the Baal's prophets, you got Asherah's prophets. And in the midst of this famine that's going on, what's taking place? Well, Jezebel, the queen, is making sure that at least all of her prophets, the prophets of Asherah, have plenty of food to eat because she's feeding them from her own kitchen. They eat at Jezebel's table.
This definitely shows you how ramped up the idolatry has gotten, right? I mean, it's one thing where you're like, oh yeah, we got some idols over here and some idols over there. We kind of let people do their own thing. They got 850 prophets for these particular idols. It seems that obviously this is the predominant worship that's going on in the land.
Yeah, yeah. And the contrast there is obvious. You've got all these hundreds of prophets who are eating where? At the queen's table.
Yeah.
And then what's happening to the true prophets of God? Well, if they haven't been martyred already, they're hiding.
Yep.
In caves, eating bread and water, just, you know, survival rations, basically. So you've got, obviously, the majority have gone the way of Baal and Asherah. The minority have gone the way of, have stayed the way of fidelity to the Lord. So that's kind of that's the setup. And we're going to have a very public demonstration here of who the true God is. Now, Ahab agrees. Why? We're not told. Maybe he was certain that 950 prophets would easily be able to take on one prophet. Or maybe he was convinced that this was taking place at Mount Carmel, which some people say Mount Carmel. Either way, it's fairly close to Phoenicia. So this was like Baal's backyard. Whatever the reasoning was, Ahab agrees to this. He probably thinks this is my grand opportunity to humiliate the prophet who's given me so many problems, and hopefully then also to take him down in this very same situation. But Ahab agrees. He sends to all the people of Israel, and he gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. When it says the prophets, for some reason, we're not told why again, but for some reason, those 400 prophets of Asherah don't show up. The prophets of Baal are there, but we're never told the prophets of Asherah are there. Maybe Jezebel kept them back. Jezebel isn't there either, so maybe the prophets of Asherah stayed with her. But either way, we do have the prophets of Baal there. They're at Mount Carmel, which is a mountain range, by the way. It's right there by the Sea of Galilee. And Elijah comes near, he gathers all the people together, and he says, how long will you, I'm reading the ESV here, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? That can be translated various ways. Here's a couple of other translations. How long will you hobble at the crossroads? Or how long will you hobble on two crutches? The Hebrew is a little bit ambiguous, but the main thing I want to point out is that this word, this verb that's translating as hobbling or limping, is the same word that's going to be used down in verse 26 for how the prophets of Baal hobbled or limped or jumped around the altar that they had made. So that's something that isn't always pointed out. Like the NIV messes that up, doesn't use the same English word to translate both of those verbs. But there's an obvious interplay here. So the people of Israel are jumping back and forth. They're hobbling between these two different opinions, just like the prophets of Baal will go hobbling or jumping around the altar. And one more thing about that. Interestingly, that's the same verb. It's pasach is the verb. Same verb that is used at the Passover for when the angel of death passed over, hopped over, we might say, the houses that were painted with the blood of the Passover lamb. So it's a verb that connotes jumping or hopping or hobbling from one place to another. And I think maybe there is an allusion back to the Passover by the use of that verb, because this is a Passover kind of situation. Because what was the Passover all about? It was God versus the true God versus the gods of the Egyptians. And you're going to have this massive death toll on Passover night with the firstborn of the Egyptians being killed. Now you're going to have a massive death toll here at Mount Carmel when the prophets of Baal are going to be slain by Elijah. So he goes on, if the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. And the people don't say anything, didn't answer him a word. So Elijah continues and he says, I only am left a prophet of Yahweh. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Then he proposes a scenario. He says, let two bulls be given to us and let them choose one bull for themselves. He's, as it were, giving them the advantage here. So choose the bull you want, cut it in pieces, lay it in the wood, but don't put any fire on it. And then I'll do the same thing. I'll prepare the other bull. I'll lay it on the wood. I'll put no fire on it. And then you call the name of your God. I'll call upon the name of Yahweh. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. Now, as I've pointed out more than once, the God who answers by fire, of course, you would expect to be Baal, because he is the God of thunder and lightning. It'd be kind of like, you know, asking Poseidon to cast a wave of the sea on this, or asking Aphrodite to make two people fall in love. Well, it should be easy, right? If you're the God of fire, of thunder, of lightning, then answering by fire should be simple, simple as it comes. All the people agree. They say, yep, sounds good to us. It is well spoken. Then Elijah turns and he addresses the prophets of Baal and basically repeats himself. He says, choose your bull, get it ready, call upon the name of your God, but don't put any fire on it. So they do. Verse 26, they took the bull that was given them and they prepared it. They called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon. So hour after hour. And what they say is, O Baal, answer us. The verb there is ana. That's the same verb that's going to be used by Elijah later on when he calls upon Yahweh. O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice and no one answered. Of course, that means there was no voice, literally, but it also means the Hebrew there is kol, and kol is often used also to describe the voice of thunder. So there was no thunder, no thunderous voice answering, which is what you would have expected from Baal. So they, again, here's our word, limped around the altar they had made, hobbled around it, just like Israel was limping between two different opinions, or hobbling between two different confessions, if you will. So they're hobbling, limping, jumping around the altar they had made. And then now we get verse 27 to one of the funniest verses in the Bible. This is Elijah mocking. This is full satire. He says, cry aloud, for he is a God. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or maybe he's asleep and it needs to be awakened. So we have Elijah, you know, he's obviously rhetorically gifted. He's a stalwart of the faith, but he's also pretty good when it comes to mockery and satire, because he's like, maybe y'all just need to ramp up the volume a little bit. I mean, maybe he's just, he's meditating somewhere. He's musing. Maybe he just had to go to the restroom. You know, your God has his pants down somewhere. He's in the bathroom and he can't hear you. Maybe he's gone on vacation. He's on a journey. Or it could be he's just asleep. Needs to be woke up. So you get a feel for Elijah's personality, I guess, in this particular scenario.
It does tell you that you know, so, you ever get the, I think about this sometimes, you know, like maybe you run into someone who believes something that seems pretty outlandish, and you wonder, like, do you really believe that? Or, you know, you wonder, like, all these prophets, like, are these all prophets of Baal? Are they there for the food at the queen's table and the prestige? Or, like, do you really believe this? It would seem that they really believe it.
Yeah, they seem to be serious and sincere. I mean, they're working it. They're trying as hard as they can to make this happen.
Yeah, because otherwise you don't take them up on this. You find a way out of it if you don't think that this is a challenge that your God can win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a false faith, but they definitely have faith in Baal that he's going to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. It just so happens that Baal isn't a thing. So.
Yeah, right. A faith in a non-thing, which is never, never a good option. So after Elijah mocks them, they take it a step further. They not only cried aloud, but they started cutting themselves with swords and lances until blood is gushing out of them. And we know this was a thing because in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, the cutting of oneself after the fashion of the pagans is prohibited. So evidently this was part of a ritual that was carried out by the Canaanites and other peoples around them. So they're cutting themselves, they're crying out, they kept on. ESV has, they raved on and on until the time of the evening offering. The verb they translated as rave is actually prophesied. But we do know that some prophesying was kind of an ecstatic experience, so probably that's why they chose raving here. They are prophets, so of course they are prophesying. They're having this frenzied, ecstatic experience while they're crying out and cutting themselves, and they've kind of worked themselves up to this feverish pitch. But we're told, again, no voice, no answer, no one paid attention. Now Elijah says to the people, come here, come to me. All the people come near to him. He repairs the altar. Rapha is the Hebrew verb there. He healed the altar. It had been dilapidated. So he's gonna fix it up. He takes 12 stones, just like Joshua took 12 stones from the Jordan River when they crossed it. Now Elijah is going to take 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, Israel shall be your name. So these 12 stones are a reminder of who you are. You are the tribes of Yahweh. And with these stones, he builds the altar, and he digs a trench around the altar, pretty, you know, a fairly deep trench. He puts wood on there, sacrifices the bull, puts it on the wood, and then, not content with all of this, he fills 4 jars with water and then puts those on the offering and on the wood, and then he says, do it again, and then he says, do it again. So, interestingly, if you got 4 jars, 3 times, 12 jars of water. So you got 12 stones, a 12-fold drenching of the altar and the stones. Water's everywhere. So it's Elijah is like doing everything to an extreme. So when the time of the offering comes, Elijah says, he prays, he says, oh Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. In fact, he doesn't say Jacob, but he's reminding them of how they got their name, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Let it be known this day that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and that I've done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord. Ana me, O Lord. Same kind of prayer that the prophets of Baal prayed and were not answered. Now Elijah says, Ana me, answer me, that this people may know, O Lord, our God, that you are the one who have turned their hearts back. So the whole purpose of this is to get the people to turn their hearts back to him. And that's precisely what's about to happen. Because verse 38 says that as soon as he finished praying, the fire of Yahweh fell. And not only did it consume that which was, you would expect to be consumed by fire, the burnt offering in the wood, but it even consumed the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. You have this vision of like what was there is now completely gone. Yeah. It's completely annihilated by the fire of Yahweh. Yeah. So all the people see it, they fall on their faces, and they finally are saying the truth. The Lord, he is God. The Lord, He is God.
Yeah, this seems like a reasonable thing to say at this point.
Yeah, I think it was the appropriate confession at this point in the scenario.
This is not some amazing faith. There is some sight involved in this. At this point, I think you know.
Yeah, it's pretty. I'm assuming that even the prophets of Baal at this point were probably ready for conversion.
Yeah.
But we'll cover this next time. But they had no chance for that because they will soon be meeting their maker. But the whole scenario is an Exodus event, but it's also it's a Sinai event because it's you kind of have this also theme of Yahweh versus the golden calf in the background there with the idolatry going on. There's a lot of biblical stories that kind of predate this that also help us to understand what's happening here. But I know we're out of time, so we'll have to pick that up in the next episode.
Well, you would think that from this day forth, obviously Israel will be a God-fearing, God-worshipping country, of course.
Of course.
Of course, that's how it'll go.
Stands to reason that would be the case.
Yeah. So we'll see if that happens. We'll see what happens to the prophets of Baal. We'll see if we can get some rain at some point because this drought has been going on for a while. We're going to have to do all of that next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, we'll see you then.